Welcome, one and all, to Strange New Worlds, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial Star Trek podcast. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hailing frequencies are open.
All scrubbed up and good as new, sir. Strange New Worlds, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek for episode 101, Strange New Worlds, comes to you now via Tagball Backtack.
Pete, so pleased to be talking about Strange New Worlds, particularly after having attended the red carpet world premiere last week, where we saw this episode and the second episode, which both of the episodes are fantastic. The experience of seeing it in New York, being this close to the cast and so forth, was just a magical adventure.
It was a phenomenal experience. Really can't say enough about it. We're going to pepper the rest really into our discussion of this episode and hold a little thing back until our Doctor Strange chat and podcast available tomorrow in the interest of full disclosure there.
I will briefly say, Pete, because you and I were able to enter the red carpet at slightly different times, and it was like, oh man, that stinks, but they're calling in people by last names and whatever, led to the serendipity. Sometimes you need to listen to the universe, and the universe listens back to you. I saw Melissa Navia getting out of the SUV and walking in, gave a little wave there, and that was the first of seeing every other cast member just about coming in the VIP entrance, where we got to gaze at them from 15 feet away, and then to later be, there were five theaters screening the two episodes, to be in the theater that had, you know, the cast and crew. We were lucky enough to have that happen. And among other things, Pete, I would like to report that Anson Mount is even more handsome in person.
Yes, that he thanked us on our way out there for coming. Really neat. Melissa Navia, Ortegas, had walked right past me after you had seen her outside. And boy, is that haircut sharp up close.
Yeah, they are in the middle of filming season two, as I think most listeners know. And
207 right now.
Wow. Clearly, they had come down mid, you know, mid-shoot. I mean, clearly, they weren't filming the day of, you know, that they went from Toronto to New York. But just to see them with their, all of them with their fresh haircuts, and then, you know, dressed up as film and TV stars, not dressed up in the, you know, the outfits and whatnot, was its own, it was its own wonderful experience, and really just a fantastic evening of seeing these episodes, seeing them with fans, being in the theater, seeing Kurtzman speak 15 feet from us, handing the mic over to Akiva Goldsman, being in the room with an Oscar winner, Pete, just the whole thing was so well done.
Really, really was. We podcast our Picard season two finale yesterday, last live action double dip Thursday for Star Trek for at least a little bit. Remains to be seen whether we'll return to that format. But you can catch that over on the Picard feed.
As you mentioned, Pete, continuing to fully dive on into the strange times from today's Strange New Worlds podcast to tomorrow's Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness podcast that we'll be doing on the Pop Culture podcast feed, on our Marvel movie podcast feed, and definitely getting into some It's a Small World connections, not the ride, just had the experience of like, what is happening on this Thursday that we're seeing Multiverse of Madness? But as you say, Pete, we won't tip it too much. Although I'll just say, Pete, it's kind of weird that you're bringing it up on the Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. So maybe something for people to keep an eye out for if they haven't seen Doctor Strange 2 yet.
Well, I just mentioned Picard and, you know, obviously some of the advertisement that connects there. But Matt, we will be bringing it back over to the Star Wars universe this week. We're going to discuss the Book of Boba Fett gallery that started streaming on Disney Plus, the behind the scenes look this week. We'll do that midweek.
And then in addition to next week's podcast, next weekend's podcast of Star Trek Strange New Worlds, on Sunday, we'll be doing a Picard season wrap Monday, May 16th. So, Pete, busy times, but to recap here, we're talking about new Star Trek. We're talking about new-ish Star Wars, in that we're seeing how the latest Star Wars series was made, new Marvel movies. This is the best of times.
It is, Matt.
With that, Pete, let's head into the mission briefing.
The spiffy new Star Trek universe card, Matt, with the Enterprise there and a little bit of the franchise theme. A nice look. Only qualm there, you didn't throw that in front of the Picard episode on the same day. I guess we can expect this, though, going forward.
Yeah, and I'll say, Pete, perhaps they held off with it, with Picard, just because as the episode of Picard started, there was not a ship to be had, and I think the expectation for season three is slightly different. Within this episode, an alarm is blaring. We see a slightly less than Star Trek bunker. It's not me being critical. I'm just saying this is not necessarily the shiny future. Where are we? Can't quite see faces as we hear Number One's voice telling us about the power of finding out that we are not alone in the universe.
Yes, a woman walks purposefully down a hallway that she turns here to enter a room filled with monitors where a character credited in the subtitles as Terminal Jockey announces they're tracking an inbound UFO that's closing in and slowing down. The woman turns and is revealed to be an alien. As Number One explains, the first visit from the stars is always the provenance of children's stories and science fiction, until it isn't. Telemetry confirms the UFO is not of planetary origin, as a visual of a Starfleet vessel with one lowered cell comes into view and fades to the white snows of Bear Creek, Montana, that Matt was so close in the first row he could not see until he watched on his TV.
Well, it's not that I couldn't see from the humble brag, the front row of the cast and crew theater. It was just that I needed to turn my head to the left to see Bear Creek, Montana. Maybe it should have been Bear Creek, Montana. I don't know, Pete. I'm not an Oscar-winning screenwriter, okay? Akiva Goldsman is. But regardless, I needed to turn to the left to see that, and then the right to be like, look, there's other elements on the screen. It was a good problem to have. In Bear Creek, Montana, someone is watching The Day the Earth Stood Still, which, Pete, I know I've seen, but probably haven't seen in 20 or 30 years. The climax of the movie talking about the benefits of some sort of cooperative federation where you don't give up your rights, only the right to be, you know, a goofus. It's Pike, not named, but come on, this is like his eighth or so episode here, making pancakes. We find, Pete, that there's a lady friend who has not, shall we say, overdressed for the boudoir. She is de-bedding and dressing. She asks if he's watching this again, and he says it's a classic.
This taking place on Stardate 1739.12. The woman there hears the communicator chirp as she feels about the bed for her partner. And then in the kitchen, wearing a Starfleet Command Division uniform, rebukes a very bearded Captain Christopher Pike for playing that movie again. Turns off and she sits, and Captain Battelle is offered more coffee by Captain Pike. Very interesting choice there of not really acknowledging the title. She asks him if he still hasn't decided. And he says that the Enterprise is still in space dock for another week. That's ages. Communicator sounds again, interestingly, Matt, on a end table next to a vintage telephone. And she asks if he's ever gonna answer it, because they can keep ignoring it, or they can talk about whatever's got him questioning his return to command and everything.
a lot of interesting things going on in this scene. One is she names him Captain Pike. So just in case you didn't know, if you're brand new to the adventure here. Also, I think the fact that she, too, is a captain removes any concerns of, superior and subordinate problems there. He says that he won't share with her what happened, even though they, you know, they're both captains and she's clearly a peer.
She's got deeper clearance than he does.
But not for this mysterious thing, he says. She gives him a smooch and says that she's shipping out tomorrow. She'll be back in a month and maybe they'll cross paths again. He says, hey, I still might be here. You never know. She hopes that will not be the case. So again, if you're coming to this episode with the knowledge of Star Trek Discovery Season 2, you understand his trajectory. What I appreciate is if you don't have that knowledge, now there's a mystery in his past, which I think over the course of the episode, they cover just fine. And honestly, Pete, even for we who have podcasted Discovery, you know, it's now several years ago. It's 2+ seasons ago. Some of these earlier elements, it's a good time for a recap / new news.
And if you need to, in between episodes, you go back and watch or rewatch your Discovery there, the DNA of which is all throughout this episode. Later, on the snow-crested mountain range dotted with wind turbines, Pike rides a horse as the shuttlecraft arrives, landing in front of him. The pilot apologizes for spooking Pike's horse, but Pike wasn't answering his communicator. Pike wants to know what the Admiral wants, and he has a first contact scenario that may have gone bad. Pike is sorry to hear that, but it's not his problem. The Admiral, here named as Bob, is not hearing Pike, and they agreed Pike would have until the Enterprise left space dock to decide. But Admiral Bob says they lost contact with her ship, and he hands Pike a pad with the last transmission, and it's number one narrating the log from the beginning of the episode. I particularly appreciated the fake out that we thought it would be Battelle to try to get him back into the game.
I must admit, Pete, that had not even occurred to me. Again, I think viewing this with, I've seen the preview a bunch of times and I've seen, you know, the Discovery episodes. But I would agree, again, your observation here is pointing to the fact that this is a sequel to the episodes which have preceded it, and this is also a brand new pilot that needs to start from scratch, and it's serving both very, very well. The Admiral notes that Enterprise leaves tomorrow. No worries about finishing the redundant system checks and whatnot. Pete, for this episode, maybe even for next episode, I'm not aware of any lack of systems being checked becoming a plot thing, but I would like to say it's officially out there that maybe everything isn't ship shape. It is wondered again by the Admiral, what happened out there to make you like this? He is told it's classified. Okay, so now we're moving up the chain of command here. The Admiral orders Chris back on the horse of the Enterprise, that is, and that's an order. We head to the credits with music and visuals that, for me, they're not quite as good as Voyager or maybe Picard, but boy, does the tune stick in the ear. This an episode that has a teleplay by Akiva Goldsman, the Oscar winner, with a story by Akiva Goldsman, Alex Kurtzman, and Jenny Lumet, and is directed by Akiva Goldsman.
On Vulcan, at the oceanside destination of Rahl, Spock asks T'Pring a query. She's asked him there on the anniversary of their first courtship event, and is wearing ritual mating colors, and the entire meal has passed without her asking him a question. She says that that's untrue, having asked about his family, Pasal's new loot recordings, his gallivanting about the galaxy with Starfleet. She's asked if there's a particular question he wanted her to ask, and he apologizes for assuming too much as she produces a triangle-shaped object, which she opens asking Spock to marry her.
Peck's performance in this scene is nuanced and subtle, a very worthy successor to Leonard Nimoy. Him having accepted this proposal, they kiss with minimal motion to the kiss. And of course, the Vulcan maitre d' asks that they take this somewhere else. So they do. We cut to a shirtless Spock, considering the beauty of planet Vulcan. T'Pring notes that there's nothing out there that is better than Vulcan. And he's going to show him something else, perhaps in the horizontal position. But his communicator pings. He notes that he has taken an oath to duty as well as to her. She is skeptical. In a real kind of there are no small actors, only small parts sort of moment, her showing this skepticism, it's just, you know, this is an actress who understands how to play a Vulcan. And in a cool move of the old and the new, Spock puts his communicator into a view screen device.
Yes, he answers it, and Pike asks if he's naked. But T'Pring, who's on a first name basis with Chris Pike, says that he was about to be because it's a special night. He apologizes and tells Spock number one is missing, and that Admiral April, so we now know that that was Bob April, Robert April, Matt, the Enterprise's very first captain, is sending them out to find number one. Spock says that he's on his way and that T'Pring will understand, which she says should have been a query.
She also notes that she won't chase him to get married. Do you get the reference, Pete?
Because
there's a classic.
Almost as if there might be some amok time coming down the road.
Well, Pete, I know this. Spock says that there's no need to chase what they have. And since Akiva Goldsman has told everyone months and months and months ago that each episode is absolutely hermetically sealed and self-contained in every way, and there's never going to be any crossover. I'm sure this won't be an issue in, you know, about a month's time. With that, we cut to a shuttle going to space dock.
Pike, not just any shuttle.
Pete, which shuttle is it?
Shuttle Stamets?
Yes, I guess the noted real-life Earth mycologist is still famous in the future?
Yes,
or do you think
in no way named for Paul Stamets. Let's make that clear to the audience. Though Discovery has, in a classified way, departed for the future.
We see Pike decidedly cleaned up, and on careful viewing, we can see that he's reading the file of La'an Noonien Singh. There's a reference to the Gorn. The shuttle moves closer to the Enterprise. A shot that's evocative of perhaps a Star Trek movie or two. The shuttle flies over it, and as Pike chats with the pilot, we see his sweet, sweet, very shortly trimmed sideburns are even more apparent. Pete, it's a brand new, old-fashioned future. And he beams out. I'm not going to ask Pete why he needs to take a shuttle to beam in. Maybe it's a tradition. Maybe it's an homage to TMP. Maybe it's just a really great way to see the Enterprise looking spiffy as we start this journey.
Spock meets him along with Chief Kyle in the transporter room. Systems are nominal, but no simulations were run. The main AI has been upgraded, and personnel rotation was in process. A few officers will have to billet after the mission, including the chief engineer and Lieutenant Kirk, whom Pike requested. So, you know, you'll get them at the end of the episode.
I love this narrative device of we have come up with a story. Okay, the Lieutenant Kirk reveal clearly meant to be an end of episode reveal, and they play more with it in the future, I suspect. But fine, they're planting a misdirect there. Totally fair territory. The notion, though, that like we're not introducing every character for the first time in this episode because of the nature of the crisis is just a really inspired turn of the story here. As Spock and Pike get into the turbo lift, Spock references missing his sister. And I feel too, Pete, you know, it's kind of this almost Marvel MCU sense of like, hey, if you've seen that story, you understand that reference. If you don't, you can go check it out. And if you don't check it out.
He has a sister that's not there, and she's gone from where they are.
But anyhow, they turbo lift to the bridge, and Pike, as they're still making their way up, Pike looks over the roster and notes that Spock is now the chief science officer, not the XO or acting XO in the absence of number one. Pike has been given a new one, and it is his security chief who is there in the captain's chair to greet him as they approach the bridge. And here she introduces herself as La'an Noonien Singh. She's told that she has big boots to fill. And I love that the performance here out of Christina Chong is kind of restrained emotionally.
Yeah, build high amongst the new cast here, and a great addition right from the start to the Star Trek universe. Lieutenant Ortega's as well on the bridge there. The pilot, the helmsman, ready to set course for Kylie 279. We have another lieutenant, an Asian woman, later known as, Lieutenant Mitchell. We get the subtitling later on. She's not referred to directly in the episode.
Indeed, in either this or another bridge scene, it's like, nice to meet you, La'an Noonien Singh. Good to see you, Lieutenant Ortegas. Spock just joined me here. We're about to be introduced to Cadet Uhura. And then there's Helm. Make us Helm. But indeed, Pete, let's focus on Cadet Uhura, the prodigy, taps her ear. We've gotten the green light from Space Dock to leave. The Enterprise launches. All are ready for Pike to give his enthusiastic words, but in his captain's chair there, he sees an image of his to-be mangled face. It takes his attention away. All notice that Pike is now not giving the moment his full attention. And it is Spock who centers him. And somewhat unenthusiastically, Pike calls for them to hit it.
Pike has Uhura take him shipwide for an announcement that they've left a little early in the new engineering area. There we see people listening, and the exposition that Starfleet sends out first contact teams. This is more for the viewer than anything else. Whenever a deep space probe detects the sign of a working warp engine, 6 days ago, a signature of a functioning warp drive appeared on Kylie 279. The USS Archer went to say hello and since has lost contact. We see the halls and then the big lounge at the forward part of the Enterprise as this message continues. If they're lucky, Pike says, we'll have some new friends, but nobody dies. This mission will not be anybody's last day.
He ends his transmission, then heads to his quarters, giving number one, Lon, the con, in his quarters.
He said calm, though. I kind of nerded out when he misspoke.
Oh, boy. Well, Pete, did Anson Mount misspeak, or is Pike so troubled by what he's about to reflect on, which will also fill any narrative gaps for new viewers, that he's messing up his own terminology?
That's not a bad explanation.
In his quarters, he's reflecting on his future as foretold to him, as we saw in Discovery. Pike ends up on the wrong side of things, scarred in pain, but now Spock has come to visit. Spock doesn't want to overstep, and Pike is going to pour a Saurian brandy, and Pike adds that he's feeling as himself. Spock does some recap on the Time Crystal mission. Pike fesses up that he saw his future, that of his own death, or the death of the man that he is now. He notes that humans think until the last instant that they will cheat death, and in almost a decade, it will happen to Pike, which suddenly does feel very soon. Spock proposes that knowledge of death is important for leadership, but Pike counters that he has felt his own death. Will that change him? Will that cause him to second guess over and over? Spock counsels that Pike just be the man that he essentially is, the captain.
So I feel the need to clarify one in case any of our listeners are not aware of where this storyline begins and later goes. So, yes, death eventually comes for all of us, but as a result of this radiation leak in a training exercise about a decade from now, Captain Pike does not die. He's placed into a wheelchair, something that will later have resonance on the original series where Spock will conduct a mission to go back and see him. And again, you can go into season two of Discovery and pick up all these pieces, again, referring to and reverential of the original series episode where Spock kind of goes rogue for his old captain. So we're filling in the blanks both before and after that. But it's curious that they keep referring to this as a death. Yes, he did refer to it as the death of the man that I am, but he's not going to die as a result of that experience.
I would agree. I suspect that probably the writer's room discussion was this. If we have Pike say, man, I'm going to end up in a wheelchair, people are going to be like, okay, so in the future, what is it, like a rocket-powered wheelchair? That's pretty cool.
Right.
No, I'm going to end up in a really bad wheelchair. Okay, it still is like a future. So I think to call it a death or as if a death, it's a bit of a narrative cheat. I think that when you look at vibrant Anson Mount riding a horse in the snow, you know, one certainly could call it a death of sorts.
You have to wonder, too, though he said he's felt it. I'm not going to spoil, but just... you know, in this super non-serialized episodic show, Matt, which we've been told about, they will do more of this in episode two, where they talk about this event. But we don't know the exact nature of how much he knows past and can feel past what we've seen.
It will certainly be interesting to see how much they continue to explore this or if this is just kind of a setting of the table in the early episodes. But as for now, they're not quite done with this notion. Pike and Spock are called to the bridge. Pike pausing and seeing his scarred face, his future in the wheelchair. But story-wise, they are now properly over Kylie 279, the Enterprise warping in. The Archer's ping signal is on the other side of the planet, indeed a very quiet planet. They scan the ship, which is empty. The roster, however, only calls for three crew members, which might be a handy way to go rescue them, particularly during COVID restrictions. I too might only send three crew members. But Pete, there's also some strange signals and evidence and whatnot coming from the planet.
Well, beyond the fact that the ship is empty, the manifest showing just Lieutenant Commander Chin Riley, Lieutenant Key, and Ensign Haddad, both astrophysicists, but there are no bodies on the ship in addition to no life signs. La'an says that if she headed to the surface, number one would have headed to the warp signature. And Spock has trouble locking onto it because the location may be shielded. Ortegas notices that there's a pretty weird signal variance, and Lon recommends deflector shields to full, which Spock protests, the obvious defensive posture being in direct violation of first contact protocols. But she says there's been no hails, there's no subspace. Chatter, there's no space traffic, there's no orbital dock. All of this points to no evidence of local space colonization. Spock says it puts him a century behind constructing warp drive. And La'an notes this anomaly is a major red flag. So Pike decides to activate shields. And it's a good thing they do.
Indeed, three plasma torpedoes are fired at them from the surface. It's noted that's 21st century tech. So how is it that they have such old weapons but still have warp? You know, there has been some evidence of a strange warp signal. Spock puts all the pieces together and says, in fact, they do not have warp, and suggests that the ship go to red alert. They do that, and Spock has figured out that they have built not a warp drive, but a warp bomb. Later, in the best darned briefing room set yet,
Yes.
It is noted that the planet has two warring factions. We see on the space map of this part of the galaxy, all of these folks have warp and are entering the Federation. However, for all the history of First Contact, which, by the way, the Vulcans pioneered, and the Vulcans always remind people that the Vulcans pioneered it, but for all the history of First Contact, warp drive has been the first use of warp tech. Pike wonders if this technology is not native. Regardless, though, since this is not a warp-capable society, General Order 1 applies, and they should get as soon as possible, to use the vernacular.
We see on the star chart there the Romulan Star Empire in the upper right-hand corner, the Klingons below it, the United Federation of Planets in the middle, Zahia, which is where the end of Star Trek Discovery Season 2 took place. Also shown, you could see Cardassia Prime if you looked in there as well. The information, the analogy made to the construction of a warp bomb before a drive compared to nuclear physics, that a bomb could be constructed before the invention, the discovery of particle physics, that too never having happened. The signature, did they know it was a weapon? Number one's crew, possibly, but the Enterprise scanners had just been updated in space dock, so we detected it. They might not have. La'an wants to beam down and bring their people home, but Pike says they have to carefully consider the possibility that tech is not native, that it may have been found in a crash of an alien ship or placed in their hands, in which case La'an concedes General Order Number 1 would apply. Spock says they cannot interfere with natural development or show themselves, but La'an says they've already seen us. So Pike says he's going to the doctor.
Indeed, and we go see Dr. Mbenga, who suggests to Pike not getting the house dressing, which is an inside joke. Reference is made to he and Pike having traveled together. Mbenga has met La'an as well. Of course, he had to certify her for duty. I don't know if it's also an opportunity to say her name again, which I'm not trying to minimize the importance of in a brand new episode when you're still introducing characters, having them say names a couple of times is always valuable for a brand new audience. Also introduced is civilian Nurse Chapel, who says that she's going to mess with their genome. Pete, lots of story in this episode. Maybe not an opportunity for every character to get like, let me sit backward on a chair and tell you about my past. So here's what happens with Chapel. She clearly has some eyes towards Spock on some kind of level, which itself is very classic Trek. Regardless, though, she's going to help them observe alien cultures without contamination, with, however, some minor biological changes, and it's something that is mostly safe.
This exchange that she's on from the Stanford Morehouse Epigenetic Project that will allow this to happen. Also, she's part of Starfleet's initiative to better observe cultures without contamination, Mbenga tells us. So what they will do will change the outside, not the inside, because that'd take longer. So also try not to get an x-ray. They're going to make these minor alterations to their genetic code and induce internal celerity to express short-term changes in their biology. La'an asks if it is safe almost every time. And she gives Pike a sedative first because his body is about to undergo compressed jury-rigged metamorphosis. It's painful. He says, "Damn the ramparts, doctor," to the nurse, which means go ahead, the damn the ramparts part. And yes, Chapel eventually does become an MD by the time the motion picture rolls around. But it was an interesting line of dialogue.
Hmm. I must confess, I heard that, but did not process it as such. Maybe the show are going for a blurring between her being a nurse and her being a doctor. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, you know, was that a mistake that made its way through, which is not impossible, but does strike me as a bit unlikely. Are we going to use doctor and nurse interchangeably? I suppose we could watch for that as well. It is made clear that these two shots, red is sedative, blue is metamorphosis. Pike takes his two, then Spock gets them. It's noted that Spock's situation is unique, so it might not last as long. Pete, no introduction in this episode, perhaps even in this entire series, of Chekhov. However, we have Chekhov's gun here in that...
Chekhov's hypo.
Indeed. Pete, with all this talk of the two shots, okay, La'an is more of a J&J gal and just wants the one shot that's no sedative. Pike, ever the dad captain, he sits next to her. He's ready to talk to her about her past, but she either wants to be mandated a sedative or to have her choice to skip it. She says that people can survive the pain, and she takes the shot. And with that, her face starts to bend, and then we move on to the next scene.
In the transporter room, Kyle informs them that the local clothing patterns have been downloaded into the buffer, as well as universal translators and tricorders, confirms no weapons, and he will send them down somewhere where there is no foot traffic. Just don't lose his socks. And then I appreciate direction here by Goldsman that makes the transporter room spin.
I personally did not love the shot, but if nothing else, it was stylish and a different way to view the transporter thing versus, like, it's 1966, so lock the camera off and step on down, guys, and film with nothing there. Give it to somebody to put animation in, and we're moving on. So there you go. Pete, we get an act break, okay? And then they're beamed down to this strange new world, specifically in an alley. That's right, Pete. In the future, Kylie 279 can have alleys. Spock is in a suit top and shorts, which is just a delightful little boy scientist or something, whatever it is that he's supposed to be cavorting
as.
It's
a school uniform, as we see later in the episode.
They step out, and a TV shows that Kylie 279 is a society in upheaval, a reminder of the United States of America and its two civil wars, its down spiral. Lon gets them closer, but they can't quite get to the building. She sees two scientists, asks for permission to act quickly, and then feigns pain. "Oh, over here, helpful scientists, my medication, fellows. Quick.
His neck.
Yeah. Which Spock learns to nerve pinch them out. And the solution is that the two scientists will get beamed up to sick bay. They're going to get info for their ID. They're going to replicate their uniforms for the three Starfleet officers. And leave them in sick bay. How are we going to do that? We'll just, you know, keep them knocked out the entire time. No problem.
No pain, no memory. They just will lose some time. In sick bay, immediately thereafter, M'Benga administers low-level sedation to one. Chapel comes back to the aspect for Spock here that they need a DNA sample because her simulations show that Spock's genetic coding is beginning to deteriorate. So she needs to synthesize a booster with actual Kylie DNA. Otherwise, he may not pass the retina scan. The first Kylian is incompatible. The other is, but the first then wakes up. They jump to the other table to sedate him, but the second gets up and runs off into the corridor. This is a Delta Scorpii 7. M'Benga will prep the booster. Chapel will catch the rabbit. He always gives her the fun job. Well, that's because she's his favorite.
And indeed, for the story, it's Chapel's time to shine, chasing after the guy. We have Ortegas on the bridge in the captain's chair, not particularly thrilled by this little oopsie-daisy. Pike is told to wait, and the solution is, all Kyle needs to do is to beam an eye salve into Spock's eye. He says that can't be done, and is told by Ortegas that he needs to find out a way to do it nonetheless. That's our good old Star Trek and Starfleet initiative there. The alien on the run gets into a turbo lift with Uhura, who talks about backtack, like on, you know, the tag ball on your planet. See, everything is just fine. So also, Pete, it's an opportunity for us to see the cadet Uhura is, a capable officer, able to manage things, and I'm sure in no way is going to have any doubt in herself in future episodes.
A student of the culture already. Pike has scanned in. La'an has also scanned in here. And then we have M'Benga activate the emergency medical transporter to get Chapel to the bridge where the other scientist was headed in the turbo lift with Uhura, who continues to chat him up, talking about the greatest tag ball match game, that between the cone rockets and boom shield. Hey, he was there. We are bonding. I'm not afraid anymore. And then we hear the transporter signal that Chapel has moved in there before we see her hypo him on the bridge, which Ortegas has welcomed him to on the Enterprise, and Uhura and Chapel meet for the first time.
We see Spock failing the eye scan, failing again, security, come with me, etc. Spock goes in for one more. The medicine beamed into his eye, we see. So now the green light goes off, and we, our Starfleet, are inside the building, now able to find some signs for number one. They need to go way down, and they enter a crowded elevator. One alien lady makes eyes at Pike. Pete, it's because he's tremendously handsome, even in person. But the same lady also notices that Spock's pointy ear, we know it's returning. To her, it's suddenly appearing. The three get out at the next stop. Spock notes that the pain is remarkable. But
remarkable. That's like, you know, they give you the face chart on the card in the hospital and say points to your pain. Quite remarkable for a Vulcan. Must be like, you know, the metal pick going into the side of somebody's head.
It's like the 9 out of 10. They are led by Lon to a particular cell. We see number one and, you know, the other two, they're happy to be saved. Pete, I like that number one, clearly, you know, a bit distressed, tired, and so forth. However, not especially surprised that it is Pike who is here to save the day. And hey, number one knows La'an, and La'an knows number one from a bad spot. Maybe we'll get some more exposition about that at another time. But right now, Pete, it's mission time.
She told her to stop being brave. Spock is told by number one, the original, that the shielding is jointed. Lieutenant Key, the female astrophysicists had used a spoon to make a hole. They may be able to route a transport signal through the gaps. Spock says they can do this if they're closer to the surface. Can number one walk? Wait, which number one? The original. She can. Pike helps her out. Looks like her left leg has either a bandage or a boot. Wasn't quite clear. Spock says it's fortunate that their route is empty, and number one tells him not to jinx, and as illogical as it might be. And then the elevator empties with these human prisoners being escorted out by Kylians. Just then, Spock kind of saves the day with his pain that's become unbearable.
Yes, he screams.
Pain!
Hiding his face, and then when he pulls his hands back, he's back in Vulcan mode. Interesting that Lon starts the fight here. I'm not saying the fight was the wrong choice. It's just here she is as the security chief, recognizing there's a moment of shock. Let's get the upper hand by starting the fight. There's some big bang booms here. The aliens all knocked out. Our crew is back in the elevator. They need to get higher. Number one has some information about this whole situation, but Lon over there isn't cleared to hear it all. I think maybe by implication, so are the other two Archer officers not cleared. But that's not really the point. The point is, hey, the story is pointing out that Lon is different and does not have some of the shared prior Enterprise experiences. Pike says, too bad. Number one essentially recaps Star Trek Discovery, episode 214, with 100 warp signatures in the sky, and this planet that they're on just saw the edge of that. They reverse engineered the warp tech, but for a bomb. Hey, we're now high enough that all can beam out. Number one notes that this is not their problem. Fine, this planet saw some stuff. They've turned it to a bomb. If they're going to destroy themselves with it, you know, General Order 1, et cetera, et cetera. But Pike says that if they leave and this planet destroys itself, then the blood is on their hands. General Order 1 is to be screwed, and it's time for this crew to mop it up. And Pike has all but he and Spock beam up.
Take Pike and Spock to their leader. Pike says that this is on them. It's their failure, and he owes the leader of the Kylians an apology. This female leader says, wait a minute, you're saying that our ingenuity was actually your mistake? And Pike says they should have been more circumspect about exposing them to their technology, that it's the tenet of their people not to influence lesser civilizations, that the power they're harnessing can bridge the gap between worlds, but its capacity for destruction can't be underestimated. The woman says that they've been in conflict with a seditious faction for centuries. Now they have the opportunity to end it. Spock notes it would be through mass murder. Pike says that negotiation and debate are obviously the ways to go. But the leader asks if they ever encounter groups that won't negotiate, which Pike says, of course they have, and then gives the Kenyan proverb here that when elephants bite, it's the grass that suffers. But she says that that proverb is less useful than a big stick. They are his rules and not her rules, so she orders them taken away. As they're leaving here, Pike makes an emergency communication to the Enterprise to head into lower orbit. Full visibility, show them what you got. There are sirens immediately after, and they look out and see the ship. He has the biggest stick, therefore he wins.
Expositional news lady, who appears to exist on most planets, notes that the two sides are going to meet to discuss the arrival of the aliens. And in that meeting room, we see the two sides yelling at each other as they are used to violence. Also watching are the Enterprise crew from the ship. La'an notes that not believing you'll die will get you killed. You know, it's something her father said before, you know, dramatic explanation of past here. The Gorn had captured her family's ship. The family was put to use at a nursery. She was the only one to survive. Her loved ones were slit open and used as food or used as breeding sacks. They all died surprised that they hadn't won. They couldn't imagine dying, but she did, and that kept her alive. And Pete, this is an example of a great use of tell, not show, because what she's describing is horrific, and it's, I think, worse in our minds and worse seeing it on her face than had they shown it.
Yes, it's at this point that Pike says he needs access to the historical database and to get Uhura to punch a signal down to the planet. We have the two leaders meeting in the same room for the first time in a century, Matt. Let's hope it's never that long on our planet before, you know, partisan parties meet. Pike beams in between them to say hi and apologizes for interrupting. He introduces himself to everybody watching. Remember, we had expositional news lady explain that it was going to be televised, and then shows them the world he's from, of Earth, and that their people are very much alike. There's images of Starfleet Academy and the museum from Star Trek Picard. But he explains that his world was not always peaceful. In fact, in the 21st century, before everything went wrong, and we see the United States Capitol, the Empire State Building, the Eiffel Tower, and the recap that he was recently treated to a glimpse of his future was not all he hoped. And what good is there in knowing that? A friend asked him recently, obviously in the understanding that it's Spock, but we're shown Spock listening to this to help us understand that. He's seen his future, and now Pike wants to show them theirs. There's several images here, one in particular of a real life still taken from a protest within the last 2 years in America. There's an audit the vote sign. There's a Biden sign of some sort. It does not seem to be pro-Biden. There is a Trump flag. Then there is a sign, and I will sanitize this, Matt, that reads, "Dear globalist health bureaucrats, F your masks." I believe the middle line says something about skin microchips. And then the last line of the placard is very visible. It said mRNA poison shot. There's also a still of the gallows in front of the Capitol from January 6th. And Pike explains that they called it Second Civil War with another image from January 6th. Then they called it the Eugenics Wars. Then just World War III.
I can understand clearly how Star Trek is delivering us a Star Trek message here, and a somber one at that, and a timely one at that. I also appreciate that they have taken some somewhat disparate threads from various points in Star Trek production's past to kind of make their point, which is to take this new notion of a second United States Civil War, roll it into the TOS era eugenics war, which maybe if we look super close should have already happened ish or not. Like, it certainly is somewhere around the 2020s rolling into World War III, which has been discussed in other Star Trek series and so forth. But just the notion of all of this gets worse and worse and worse, which is not always the Star Trek medicine we want, or it's not the Star Trek outcome we want, but they're giving us some stiff medicine here. There are eruptions and explosions that end up killing 30% of the Earth's population. It was global suicide. And this planet, Kylie-279, now has the means to bomb each other, just like the power that was had on Earth. But Pike believes that their destinies are their own. There is a power of possibility that life can be worn gloriously. The future is what we can make it. So go to war or join our Federation of Planets and reach for the stars. The choice is yours.
And then there's some great reaction shots in a classroom. A little girl has drawn the Enterprise on the chalkboard as she takes her seat, and her teacher and her classmates look on in some sort of lab setting. The diagram of Spock against a Kylian is looked at with a pointer. And then there's an engineer who is looking at the Enterprise and drawing up blueprints before we have some sort of religious leaders who have a cutout of a heart and that of an Enterprise, which morphs into our Enterprise at warp.
That last shot, a bit of a visual quote of a similar moment for the opening act of Star Trek Into Darkness. And
yep.
You know, if you're going to quote something, no, I have no problem with that movie, but if you're going to quote anything from it visually, I mean, that's a heck of a thing to quote. Some time has passed, and we see the Enterprise going to Starbase One. And now Admiral April has convinced Starfleet that they, the Enterprise crew, haven't broken General Order One, given that the battle that the Kylians saw didn't take place. It can be officially determined that it that the people of Kylie 279 were not impacted by the Federation to begin with. So definitely some legal machinations here to get our crew out of trouble. But one thing has been learned, Pete, by Starfleet, by everyone, that people aren't listening to General Order 1 enough. So now they're going to rename it the Prime Directive just to really make sure people start listening to it.
That'll never stick, Pike notes. Number one asks for permission to return to the Enterprise, which April says is up to Pike if he plans on keeping the chair.
Indeed he is. And we have still some more time passing. Pike reading files. Lon is ready to tell him more. She was put into space on a raft of sorts, you know, a space raft, by the Gorn, not meant to survive, but she did. Number one was on the ship that had rescued her. They were on the King Jr. Yes, the Martin Luther King Jr. Lon had chosen not to share this connection with number one, that she has with number one. She chose not to share this with Pike, but it is noted that her record is otherwise spotless. Pike talks about working together being our greatest strength. La'an notes that other people are nonetheless a challenge for her. But Pike talks about the domes of this starbase, that seed pods were sent out into space during World War III. And when things had finally settled down, they discovered that the seeds had grown into these forests. And even in space, remarkable growth is possible. And here he officially offers La'an a commission on the Enterprise.
In a captain's log recorded on Stardate 2259.42, which is significantly far past the 1739 of the beginning of the episode, Pike tells us here that the Earth, its dust and sky, is his hearth, but the Enterprise is his home, and that you go forward with whatever shadows you bring with you, making the light all the brighter. He's a lucky man. As he hits the bridge here, and number one tells him the crew rotation is complete. Lieutenant Kirk is on the way to the bridge as requested. The new security chief, La'an, of course, is in place, and Ortegas says they are ready to depart Starbase One.
We have Kirk stepping up with a mustache. Hello, Chris. Oh, Captain. Oh, hello, Samuel Kirk. Your family is all good, I hope. And by the way, this guy, Spock over here, you know, since you, Samuel Kirk, are in life sciences, Spock is going to be your new boss. So time for the ship to officially leave. As for a course or a mission, what shall it be? Pike says the mission is to explore, to boldly go. Intercut with this, we see Hemmer beaming in. Pete, I hope we get more of Hemmer next week.
We will.
And Pike says to take her out, warp factor 2, and now with more enthusiasm, hit it.
At the very end, that this episode is for April Nosepora, and that the cast and crew love her. She was also given a dedication during Discovery. April Nosepora lost her life to cancer back in December.
With that incoming threat analysis, Pete, let's talk about the threat of destiny.
It's a really interesting way to set up a pilot. I suppose if you didn't have Discovery, you could certainly do this with what Pike knows is coming. But because we've had that, because we've seen it, you know, to have him go to this willfully, to see the change in the episode from taking himself out of the equation for fear of what happened, that he can't confide it into anybody else. And now the people he's let in on it, indeed a whole world of Kylie 279, that he's gotten a glimpse of his future, which allows him to give them a glimpse of theirs. So that narrative through line, really, really effective.
I think that the episode really does such an amazing job making that threat, which is now, of course, a part of his life and a part of his mindset, making that threat so apparent while also not rehashing too much for those who know it well, whether you know it well from Discovery or you know it well from Classic Trek. It would have been a lesser episode if it was like, oh man, we need to time crystal. Like, we need to get that in his head as a brand new adventure. Now, that, of course, would presuppose that he wasn't on Discovery and you couldn't just, you know, do it essentially as a previously on sort of thing. But it's such an easy pilot to take down. And the fact that they're dealing with, well, what does the audience know and not know? What do we need to recap? What do we need to teach anew and so forth? It's quite a thing to behold.
In using the inhabitants of Kylie 279 in this episode as a means of the first contact scenario, they're very clear parallels to Earth of our present, this, you know, faction idea, the idea of sedition, of traitors, of, you know, the news saying, well, you know, there's this weapon that there's whispers of they want to use, the government wants to use on its own people. You know, obviously the warp bomb thing being fiction, but, you know, not wholly unbelievable from the way that everything is presented. Once Pike makes his big pitch,
it's interesting too to see the Kyleans as a function of this story and a function of this show, which I don't think this show has been made as quote unquote a response to Star Trek Discovery. But if the people behind it have heard, you know, the audience likes some of this, the audience likes some of, you know, whatever it is, here's different perspectives from the audience, as well as how do we just make this a different show? And if the basic premise is a different strange new world each week, and while we're at it, we're going to have a planet and a lesson, and we're going to tie it up all in a bow. Okay, fine. You and I have joked a bit. They sold this as like as self-contained as you could possibly imagine. And having seen the episode, that's not the case in terms of character arcs. However, Pete, I think it's safe to say we're not going back to Kylie 279 ever again in any substantial way. I don't think they left the thing back there that they now need to go get to power the thing that they'll need to fight in episode 8. You know, it's not that sort of thing. And that's okay, too. A clear setting with a clear story and a clear lesson at the end. I'm sure, Pete, some people are howling, oh, wait, Star Trek is talking about the now. They've never done this before. Ack. But I think that this was, in terms of this show saying, the Kyleans are us. We are the Kyleans. Get used to it being this kind of show. I'm welcoming that quite a bit.
I wonder if the show will have anything to say about zealotry next week.
Let's use our long-range sensors to scan for some theories. Pete, do you think this name, the Prime Directive, will that stick around?
Totally.
Do you think they're going to continue to treat it as wibbly-wobbly in the future as they did in this episode?
I mean, the ability for story sense of, you know, when we would use it and when we would not, and then the idea that, you know, Pike decides to scrap it, and then the Admiral goes to bat for him and finds a loophole. I think we have decades of past and future storytelling where it can be conveniently pushed aside.
A bit more seriously, this episode features, number one, on the story sidelines for story reasons that make complete sense to us, knowing that number one is not the focus of the second episode, how do you think they will continue to use Rebecca Romijn amidst all these other great characters, some of whom we, you know, are just yearning to learn more about?
As we were talking with our guest for the premiere afterward, that she's billed last, but with the, you know, Vanity and Rebecca Romijn still a major part of the cast, but somebody that, you know, they're gonna pepper in, and I think she'll be just as present and as part of it. I don't think it's like a, you know, Pike is dad and she is mom. I think she's more like, and they established it with the Laan relationship, more like an aunt. Your cool aunt who can kick some butt and, you know, put on a different costume in some episodes and still really, really going to participate.
Well, funny you should mention Laan. I know that next week's episode is surprisingly character centric while still getting everybody in there, but I know it's not focusing on Laan. So do you think that next week starts a pattern of character centric episodes for whether it's the first 6-7 episodes? You know, do you think that's setting up a pattern? Because I want to know more about all these characters, particularly the brand new ones, or, you know, brand new in that Uhura's kind of brand new. You know what I mean?
There is a school of thought in episodic TV storytelling. Screenwriters say that you have 7 episodes. And, you know, once those 7 episodes have passed, the show and the characters are pretty much, you know, solidified. So I think that we will obviously continue to progress. Some episodes in an episodic sense will be more character centric, some a little bit more rounded, and we'll see how they take it.
I certainly would welcome the idea that we're giving each character kind of, you know, making them the star of an episode, and how they interact with others and so forth. I think it's something that has not been done in a while, so I think there's a lot of potential there. Pete, we were at the premiere, and I think probably for all viewers who knew a little bit about the show news, we were trying to figure out how it is that there was a Kirk coming onto the show in this episode, but they've only just cast the Kirk actor for season two. So did they go back and put footage in? Like, it was such a weird idea to figure out how that was done. But then the reveal that this was, in fact, George Samuel, Sam Kirk, whose endpoint we know from the original series. That was a twist I did not see coming at all. I think that was a fun... I don't know what they're going to be doing with him or how long he will be on the show, but that was a really fun twist.
And then they made an announcement, hey, don't get up between the first episode and the second episode, because we got a little something. And I said to our guest, who was seated next to me, Matt was in the row in front of us, oh, they're going to bring out the Kirk actor. That I didn't happen.
Well, yeah, I
thought they were going to bring out Paul Wesley, who, you know, Matt has been the one to tell me here went to the high school that I graduated from and our guest graduated from.
I think that what happened at the premiere was this. I believe it was the executive producer and co-showrunner Henry Alonso Myers who had said that. I think that they were playing this delightful game of no one will guess that we're going to show two episodes, even though it was just, in my mind, widely understood they were going to be showing two episodes. So I believe his statement was, don't get up in between don't get up at the end because we have a surprise. And I think it was meant to be, the surprise is that at the end of this episode, Pike says, hit it. And it goes, da 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 da. And then we say, oh, well, there's some more story. That's interesting. Wait, it's a teaser act. Boom, credits. And indeed, there was a fan, not a cast and crew member, who when the second credit sequence for our viewing came, he was like, yes, second episode. So I think that's what they were going for.
They did tell us two episodes would run, though.
True. I think, though, there was a little, like, who was the they who said that?
It was, if it wasn't Kurtzman, it was Alonso Myers.
Again, I think they were just slightly fumbling, like, it's a surprise, or do they know it? Or wait, did he just say, I think it was a little bit of a fumble of, surprise, you're getting two episodes. So I think that was the source of the confusion.
So Matt, do you think that maybe that was the source of the Stardate screw up in the episode?
Well, look, here is my pinky up Star Trek response to wibbly wobbly Stardates in this episode. Star Trek as a production did not have a concerted calendar for Stardates until Star Trek The Next Generation. In my mind, anything before that is literally just them making stuff up. Now, if you want to say, yeah, but this was not made, you know, in the summer. This was not an episode that was written in the summer of 1968 after the show almost got canceled by NBC. Like, they're making it in the now, to which I would say, I still think that they can just throw a bunch of numbers up there and not really care, versus the very regimented, like, Star Trek Next Generation is Stardate 4-1 something, because that one is for the first season, and if it's 4-1-1, then you're in the first, you know, 10th or 100th of the season, and if it's 4-1-9, then you're almost at the end of the season. Like, I don't think that they're doing that here, so it doesn't bother me in the slightest.
All right, Matt, it's time to confront those canon race warriors.
Look, anybody... To me, it was a delightful moment when it was like, wait, the Admiral's name is Bob? Okay, fine. Wait, that's April. Wait, that's Robert April. Okay, in my Star Trek encyclopedia, they did an in-joke where Mike Okuda photoshopped Gene Roddenberry's head onto William Shatner's body and said that was Robert April. And then in the animated show, it was a white guy. Cool. Robert April is now of African descent. Not a problem. For anybody for whom it is a problem, A, this show might not be for you. B, Pete, do you know who said that the animated series wasn't canon?
I believe it was the great bird of the galaxy, Gene Roddenberry.
There you go. So if you are a mildly racist Star Trek canon warrior, and you're using the fact that he appeared white in the cartoon as proof that they've broken your canon, well, but Daddy Gene said that that didn't count, so therefore, A, it shouldn't count as the canon, and B, it's Star Trek, and no one cares about this ultra, ultra, ultra low-tier character who appeared in one episode of the cartoon. No one really should care that they've changed his, you know, racial background and so forth, because, I don't know, he was a charismatic and handsome fella there who seems capable to go toe-to-toe with Anson Mount and also give him orders. That's, and we also get the bonus of, you know, more realistic representation and all of that. So certainly worked for me.
The same could be said for Transporter Officer Kyle. Chief Kyle from the original series was a Caucasian man. We can go about this a couple different ways, because everybody named Kyle only appears one way. They could be two completely different characters. Or Matt, in a universe in which we had a medical character explain, hey, I can mess with your genome. I mean, the animated series episode with April could have been an example of that, okay, where it got changed. Same with Kyle, if indeed they're even the same character. The point of canon is this, and I think Leonard Nimoy said it best, you need to calm down about it.
And I would add to that, clearly the current, you know, the current Star Trek regime is less concerned with creating a shot-for-shot remake of everything classic Trek and just living in that world, still calling it the Prime Universe, because, Pete, there was enough complaints about how the Kelvin universe wasn't real Star Trek and all that. So it's like, all right, message received. You don't want us taking away your Star Trek, even though we came up with a really novel story to have both exist side by side. But fine, you don't like that. We're going to make this canon Star Trek, but we can't get stuck in 1960s production values. Not when the future of a major, you know, media conglomerate streamer is riding on it. We're going to put more money in it than, you know, a lesser studio in Desilu has sold a show. You know, like, they're okay recasting people by race. They're okay building a better set. They're okay adding a dining deck onto the Enterprise. They're okay remaking engineering to be the big engine room of a cruiser. They're okay taking the original spirit of Pike's Quarters from conceptual drawings, which kind of sort of got interpreted in the cage, but it still didn't look great. And now they've gone back to that original concept and fully fleshed it out as an expensive set. They're okay with all of this and still saying, just squint a little bit, it's all the same Star Trek. Somehow the Pike in the cage who pouts on his bed where there's a TV and he talks to the doctor who pours him a drink, somehow that's the exact same room as the one where Pike is pouting and pours a drink for Spock in this episode. Don't worry about the fact that it's not quite the same. It just is. Just live it, breathe it, go for it.
It's still Star Trek. Matt, what about these substitute captain gigs that apparently Number One took up for the USS Archer as Pike was cooling his heels in Bear Creek, Montana?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was meant to be a full-on substitute captain gig like we saw in Lower Decks, or if it was just, you know, Number One is in command of this modest little mission to go take a peek at a modest little planet that's out of the way, that, you know, ended up obviously being a bigger thing because it's a premiere episode of a new Star Trek series and all of that. I do like the idea. It's in line with Number One being so driven that, you know, more downtime after a big galactic battle for the future of everything, she's just going to go out there on another mission.
The Vulcan engagement practices here to Pring proposing to Spock, but this underlying tension that they have for a wedding that will not happen in the original series.
Yeah, and again, lots of credit to actress Gia Sandhu, who's playing T'Pring. She doesn't get many scenes, and obviously she's not getting the full human palette of emotions since she's playing a Vulcan. Still, she has to punch through to be a little saucy at dinner, like, oh, she's been flirting the entire time by not bringing up the fact that she's wearing the traditional maiden colors and they're going to get engaged. Her disappointment that Spock must leave so quickly. All of this needs to be, you know, needs to be put on screen in an unconventional way due to the character that she's playing. I hope that we see more of her. I know that you've whispered that there might be a Spock centric episode. In fact, with the first five titles out, I'm going to guess, Pete, maybe it's the fifth episode. So I would welcome more of that. I mean, the big thing, when you go back and watch Next Generation episodes now, the big thing where you go, oh my goodness, this has not aged well. It's not the effects. It's not the acting. It's not even necessarily the in-episode metaphors for, you know, these people and their strife, or, you know, to learn the new things. It's that at the end of the episode, you go, wow, what a great time. Now we're all going to reset emotionally because we don't carry over from week to week. I look forward to getting more to Pring so that this can be an ongoing story.
The backstory here built in for La'an, who we know because of the Noonien Sing, there is a Khan connection, and that has been said by the producers will eventually be explored. But this first contact with the Gorn as part of her backstory, we know the Gorn, of course, from the original series, that episode Arena, where Kirk and a Gorn captain wind up going mano a mano in the stuff of memes forever. Be nice maybe to get some of the species, if not maybe even this experience that La'an went through.
Yeah, I know there's a bit of gnashing of teeth, like the Gorn were supposed to be Brandy brand new in Arena, but, you know, but what does it all mean? I think the idea that, hey, the Gorn are out there, there's kind of rumors of them, or there's glimpses of them, or there's stories of them, but it's not like...
There's a Gorn skeleton in Captain Lorca's Museum of Deadly Things on Discovery.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you want to say, well, first of all, that does not need to be explained away. I think that if anything, it just adds to the notion of, you know, he's heard tell of them, or he's interacted with them, but it's been a lot less than like full-on official report about the Gorn. Today, a captain and a Federation captain and a Gorn captain sat down and broke bread and decided to be friends, and we're swapping flags and all. Like, it's this threat that's kind of out there at the very edges of space, which I'm great with.
I found it particularly impressive. I mentioned before the amount of Discovery DNA that is in the pilot here that is a spinoff of that other series, the one that brought Star Trek back. This classified nature of what happened to Discovery heading to the future and the battle of Zahia against Control. Spock's sister, Michael Burnham, though not name-checked in the episode, this accident vision that Pike has had from a mission to the Klingon moon of Borath, where a red angel signal had appeared and they, you know, had essentially sent a signal so that they could go there and go through that experience because they needed the time crystal to power the red angel suit. So really well done how it's all woven into it instead of just, hey, here's the Enterprise and there they go.
It felt like the best way to use some larger Star Trek universe essential knowledge versus, you know, the feeling of like, you know, well, I can't just sit down with somebody and watch Avengers Endgame. You need to watch Infinity War before it. And for you to really understand some of that, well, you really need to watch Civil War. And then you also need, you know, like, there's a certain point, and I think that maybe this is being explored across these film and TV universes. I think that it's starting to be figured out that if it gets too big, then now it's great that things are hot right now, but now that's also a barrier to new people hopping on. And what does that mean, and how do you manage with that? And we've certainly spent a lot of time in the Discovery podcast talking about how is Star Trek being managed relative to some of these other properties. I think here you see, you know, if you want more, go back and watch the more. However, there's no scraps left from this episode where you're like, I still don't understand. The answer is, you know, there was the Discovery, which they showed. It went, I don't know if they outright say it went to the future, but there it is. You know, it we did. Know, okay, going to the future, big battle, big space, like everything kind of is laid out emotionally. And I'm really appreciating how our strange new world in this episode is a strange new world that also intersected with that Pike flashback portion of it. Like, there's Pike's flashback, and then there's the end of Discovery, and there's the I Miss My Sister, and all of that has been reflected, maybe not every little story element, but all of that has been reflected to Kylie 279, which gives everybody a chance to get it all out there and say the thing. And then now it's kind of been dealt with, and I would not expect, you know, in episode 4, Spock is like, oh man, Captain, but I really, really miss my sister. No, it's just going to be like, great, we've... Yeah. It's not that we need to move on, but we've said it. Now we can move on.
There's the line that La'an gives when she refuses the sedative. And just shortly before, she says people survive things. And Benga takes his right pointer and, you know, sweeps it under his right eye, which she returns. So not quite clear what that was. After she says the line about people surviving things, Pike's resonance here, surviving and living. So the simpatico that the two have, obviously, in terms of their backstories. The other thing, too, and, you know, I mentioned within the recap of the episode, okay, so Pike is not going to die as a result of the training exercise that goes awry that results of putting him in a wheelchair. It also, in a futuristic story in which we can alter genomes and develop all sorts of therapies, it also doesn't mean he can stay or has to stay in that forever.
I certainly would agree that there's flexibility in that department. And to go back to Mbenga's, shared motion with La'an, I'm reminded of let me do this way. Perhaps that was come up with by the actors. Perhaps that was in the script. As to what it refers to, I'm reminded of the story from the first season of The West Wing, where Toby, actor Richard Schiff, just told the production, like, hey, my character wears a wedding ring. And they're like, oh, well, we don't have you written as married. He's like, my guy wears a wedding ring. I don't know why. You can figure it out. And later on, they were like, okay, he wears a wedding ring, but there's no wife. What does that mean? They started to backtrack from there, from his instinct. So I mention that just because there's not necessarily like the grand reveal in a particular episode that all along that motion was evidence that when they were on, you know, such and such planet, that was the signal for everlasting love. It could just be something somebody came up with as a placeholder for an adventure in the past. And it wasn't necessarily done with a seed towards the future. However, it's nonetheless might seed one day. With that, let's go to Hailing Frequencies.
Hailing Frequencies open, sir.
We head to our weekly Twitter poll, which had the following reactions here. Pete, I know that for some of the other Star Trek things, to do a 4-3-2-1 or similar, it brings out the haters. What's with their haterade and all? But with this modest delay between the, or a Strange New Worlds pilot filmed in 1965 and the show as envisioned here, premiering in 2022, what did people think? Pete, we'll go from the bottom up. 2 stars, Snow is Cold and Coarse, got 0%. a little merging of universes there, but hey. I was trying to affect the angry fan, you know. 3 stars, Commandering Start, got 0%. 4 stars, Captained My Interest, got 18.9%. And then 5 stars, Admirable, got 81.1%. Some replies here to the tweet. James is sagacious. That's Big Killin' on Twitter. A great start. The show fits perfectly into the world Disco showed us, but also gives a style all its own that upgrades TOS and lays the groundwork for everything that comes after. Hope all the bros can finally enjoy a non-political show. Wink. Well done there, James. I see what you did. This was one of the most overtly political episodes of modern Star Trek. We hear from Hail Hydra. That's at Hydra_lives. I'm no Trek super fan by any means, but have revisited my fandom with Disco, Picard, and now Strange New Worlds. I have a question about timing. Why/how did the show start on Stardate 1739.12 but end on 2259.42? Yep. Pete, I know you discussed it as an error. I'd like to say this. How about time dilation due to warp? That sounds like a gene thing. G-E-N-E.
It could. Or, you know, yeah.
JT Adkins, that's JTA is me, says, awesome start, lots of fun. Love the effortless way they make it clear that Pike's Bridge crew is comfortable with each other and close-knit. What's the finger under the eye salute? Also appreciate tremendously the Vulcan wit with T'Pring and Spock. Definitely an on-point portrayal of the genuine but well-hidden emotional life of Vulcans. Will Sam Kirk turn out to be the Trek Ted Lasso? The stash says yes. Pete, all I will say is this. There's a line in next week's episode about the mustache that I genuinely have a lot to say about. But that's next week in our time dilation. That's Stardate 2259.92, not where we're at the end of this episode. Pete, let's hear from Make It So. That's at KCLYLE1 on Twitter. Great start. Nice to see they didn't forget what happened in Discovery. I like the cast, including the updated Uhura and Chapel. I hope the standalone episode format gives the Bridge crew more room to shine than Disco. Spider-Ham Lincoln, TessLC139 on Twitter. Star Trek is life. A few thoughts. Anson Mount's Pike continues to delight. My favorite characters for 101 alphabetically. April, Chapter, La'an, Mbenga. My only disappointment, barely any Hemmer. Spoiler, there's more next week. The commentary in the 21st century, yikes. Would have preferred a different episode title, such as Prime Directive, Biggest Stick, Reach for the Stars, or Lucky Man. Best surprise, Samuel Kirk, who's totally Galaxy Quest's Guy Fleegman. Wow, that's a great thought there. And finally...
Just wait till next week.
Indeed. Next week will be a heart-stopping episode. And Spider-Ham Lincoln says, finally never get the house dressing. Pete, let's move on to Jackie Wolf on Twitter. That's at Jackie Wolf. Admirable, indeed. They may as well have named this episode Mirror, Mirror, because the very clear goal was to inspire self-reflection in viewers of this new series. It's not lost on me that the original Star Trek aired at a time of societal uncertainty, with nuclear warfare being a very real threat in the 1960s. Now we have another brand new series, which somehow manages to pay homage to classic Trek while feeling new and relevant. I noticed that the protest footage seen on the TVs of Kylie 279 was rather obviously recycled from today's Ukraine conflict. And while I first chalked that up to sloppiness, I do wonder if they left it that way on purpose so that we, the viewers, could better see ourselves in the episode. Not that I'm complaining. Trek has always been political and progressive. And I'll watch Anson Mountain literally anything. Looking forward to more great episodes. Live long and prosper. Thanks, as always, to Matt and Pete for your hard work. So Pete, aside from blushing at the compliment there, yeah, I would agree with Jackie that has been left in to say, go look it up. Let's go have a side discussion about the terrible situation going on in Ukraine.
That we would be able to look at what we're going through the lens of this hopeful future, that we're gonna figure it out. Like, that gives me a reason every day to hope that we're striving closer to that and less to the awful events we've experienced.
Well, Pete, let's switch over to Apple Podcasts. What news do you have about us there?
We have a review from JTA Is Me. The headline is "Boldly Go to This Podcast," 5 stars, and it reads, "No Star Trek series is complete without giving a listen to the genial geniuses at Fantastic Geek. They know their Trek, and they are a wonderful antidote to the unfortunate, noisy fringe that likes to do nothing but complain about Trek. How can people who love Star Trek enjoy Star Trek? By coming along for the ride with Matt and Pete."
Well, thank you, JT, for those kind words. And I don't know about the genius part, but you know what? I will take the compliment nonetheless. And with that, Pete, let's switch on over to some of the wise words from Fred in the Netherlands.
Hello, Matt and Pete, and all listeners to Fantastic Geek. This is Fred from the Netherlands with some feedback for the series premiere of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. Very nice to hear in the Fantastic Geek podcast about Picard Season 2 Episode 9 that you went to a theater to see the first 2 episodes together with a lot of the cast and crew of Strange New Worlds, including Rebecca Romijn, who has Dutch roots. Actually, Rebecca Romijn, as we pronounce it properly in Dutch. And you sent me a message, Pete, in the Fantastic Geek Facebook DM. "That Dutch actress is even more statuesque when you sit by her." Well, the Dutch people are still, although they shrunk 1 centimeter, the tallest people in the world. Why did they shrink? There was articles in The Guardian and all kinds of places. There was a research done, and since I think 20 years or 25 years, the Dutch are indeed the tallest people in the world, but they shrunk. Of course, that could be caused by immigration, but even if they take those people out, so just take people who have 4 Dutch grandparents, then even we got a little shorter, but still the tallest people in the world. And the explanation for that is probably within the food. So if we're starting to eat better, perhaps we can maintain this position. And you have some Dutch ancestry as well, Pete. But when I saw pictures of you, your Dutch genes are probably intermixed a little bit with something else. But talking about sitting next to somebody, I was very much and pleasantly surprised to see in one of the very first scenes Melanie Scrofano as Captain Battelle, obviously Captain Pike's girlfriend. And as you said, next to Rebecca Romijn, I once sat directly next to Melanie Scrofano because I attended a Wynonna Earp fan convention and had a meet and greet with her there. I think they did a marvelous job in their visuals and their, let's say, Star Trek equipment. It looks new, but if you look, for instance, at the model of the communicator or the model of a shuttlecraft, really, really connected to the original series. I think they do it better here than in Star Trek Discovery. Although Star Trek Discovery up till season 3 is, of course, in the sense of the timeline before this. Talking about Discovery, I think the connection here, the references to Discovery is subtle and nice and not too much. What I do think is too much is the amount of times that Pike sees himself die or sees that damaged face of himself. It's a little bit too much for me. It also connects to the original series because I get the impression that in the 5-year mission setting, this will be also story of the week things. So for instance, now the first contact thing with Una there, I think that's a story of the week. I wonder how much they will keep that up. I also wonder what they will do with this Samuel Kirk. obviously the brother of James T. Kirk, what his role will be. And last remark, I really love that Nurse Chapel, especially when she says, "I'm going to mess with your genome." That was all for now. Greetings, all the best, Fred from the Netherlands.
Well, Fred, of course, professionally a geneticist, and yes, I'm only 5 foot 5 inches tall, so clearly I'm on the lower end of my Dutch genes there. But yeah, I appreciate that coming from Fred.
Fred zeroing in there on the delicious reveal at the end of Lieutenant Kirk, albeit Samuel Kirk. Without tipping the hand too much towards next week, it is interesting. It's an interesting story decision to have a Kirk, and obviously Samuel Kirk being the brother of James T. Kirk, to have another Kirk intersecting with the Enterprise. I don't know that that's a decision that is an obvious one. I do give credit to the show, not just go for the zinger, but the fact that Sam Kirk is used in the story next week. You know, if nothing else, they're committing to it, you know, while pretending that there's not going to be any other Kirk in the future. And always in our future, Pete, is the support we receive from those who go to patreon.com/fantasticgeek, keeping us so proud that we are listener supported, particularly at a time where those storage and bandwidth costs are on the rise.
Our present and our past as well, keeping our entire backlog up there on Fantastic Geek for all of our listeners. So head over to patreon.com/fantasticgeek today. All sorts of levels to select from, but just $1 a month gets you in that door. Can't contribute right now. Be like JTA is me. Go over to Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating in seconds, a review in just a little while longer to any of our 30 podcast feeds.
And Pete, let's keep the conversation going. How can people be in touch with you on Twitter?
Find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J-K-E-T-E-R, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 12,444 followers. Can't be wrong.
Well, I'm personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. Do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But maybe there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with a PH, all one word, like it today.
If you're listening on the Pop Culture Podcast feed, we're back tomorrow evening to talk Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And then midweek, give a little update there to the behind the scenes of the Book of Boba Fett. If you're just here for Star Trek Strange New Worlds, we will be back next Star Trek Sunday as we continue to make our way through this first season of the series. With that, Pete, I will say adios to all the listeners and give you the final word.
Always when I'm in the captain's chair.